Blog Talk Radio.
3921 Flatted 2, Frenchie. Sidewinder, 22, Juliet.
Joe Bulldog is 7 miles west of Star Wars Canyon now at 500 AM below. And 300 indicated.
Reno 3-1, flat of 4, Point India. Reno 3-1, flight, we're Point Juliet.
You are listening to Patriot Nation Radio Live, 347-637-3942.
Welcome, everyone, to the show tonight, Patriot Nation Radio, the American Allegiance Show. I'm your host, Kevin White, your capable and handsome host, or I don't know, that's subjectable. Anyway, we have a great guest tonight. It's a friend of mine that I used to work with when I was in the military. His name is Brad Glanz, and he is a former fighter pilot. We're going to talk about that tonight. Anyway, American Allegiance Show coming to you up your corner, around the block and everything, and we're glad to be here again. Everything's going well for us this week. And we're going to start the show off by bringing our guest on, and he's going to tell you a little bit about himself. Brad, how are you doing today?
Good, Kevin. I'm good. And you're selling yourself short, man. You're very capable and very handsome.
Thank you so much. you know what? Only military guys would say that, right?
You're right.
So anyway, tell us about your career, about what you did for the Air Force in general.
Sure. Yeah, I was 21 years in. I was enlisted for the first 6 years as air crew life support, and then I got picked up for pilot training and spent the next 15 years flying the F-16 at the 180th Fighter Wing in Toledo.
Awesome. So what did you do before you were selected as a pilot candidate?
I was in the air crew life support. Our job mainly entailed taking care of the gear for the pilots. So we did parachute maintenance, took care of the helmets, the G-suits, the harnesses, all the equipment, the survival kits. We did inspection on the ejection seats. All that kind of stuff, anti-exposure suits. So basically, by the time I became a pilot, I was very familiar with the equipment I was going to use because I was able to spend 6 years working on it.
That's awesome, and that's not an easy field. I used to go over to ops, and I'd talk to those guys and see them there. So tell us about the flight school. First of all, what kind of requirements did you have to meet to actually become a pilot? What was involved in that?
Oh, you have to obviously take the Air Force Officer Qualifying Test, the AFOQT, and score very, very highly on that. Then they do what's called the BATS test. I think it's a basic aptitude testing. A lot of coordination stuff. You know, doing one thing with the left hand, another thing with the right hand. And the whole time there might be numbers popping up on the screen that you have to be able to recall in a certain order. And, you know, it's just designed to, as best you can, simulate the environment of flying a fighter where, you know, your left hand's on the throttle, your right hand's on the stick, you know, you're talking on the radio, looking in the radar, checking your targeting pod, maintaining awareness on your fuel state, your wingman's fuel state, their position, your position within country, you know, all the things. I mean, you're just literally doing and juggling, you know, 6 to 9 things at a time. And so it's designed to kind of, you know, test and see if you're going to be capable of doing that type of a workload, or if you're just going to let the whole house of cards come crumbling down.
Right. I know that fighter pilots are multitaskers, and I people don't realize that a lot of these pilots, the candidates, they get hard science majors, like engineers and everything. There's a lot of, and we also had doctors that were flying for us as well. The very smart, talented people are flying these fighters.
Yeah, that's, you know, the one thing that's impressed me just from the guys that I flew with and that I come across, you know, in the different deployments is that, you know, generally speaking, I mean, the number one trait that you're looking for in a guy, I mean, they're going to be successful no matter what, you know, area of life or what discipline they choose to pursue. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're an engineer or whether, you know, for me, I was a physical therapist. That was what my degree was in, and that's what I'm doing now. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, you could take any fighter pilot, put them in just about any situation, they're going to be able to adapt, improvise, overcome, and do an excellent job for you. And I'm not speaking about myself. I'm talking about the guys that I flew with. Just amazing guys, very smart, incredibly adaptable, innovative, you know, always thinking outside the container. That was probably the biggest thing, you know, after I had gotten out of school and was, you know, interviewing guys as we're bringing more pilots on board. It's just looking, you know, we would ask them questions in the interview, things that you couldn't possibly prepare for or have an answer for, just to kind of see how they think on their feet, because, you know, that is so much of what we end up doing when we put the gear in the well and take off. You know, just being able to, you know, we'll spend hours briefing a plan, and then the minute you put the gear in the well, you get contacted by Warhawk, and they're retasking you to something completely different that you have no imagery, no frequencies, no, you know, coordinates for, and you turn, you know, over your 20 pages of paper and just start writing and doing it from scratch. So it truly is, you know, the hallmark of a good fighter pilot is just, you know, being able to adapt and roll with the punches and then, you know, still go out and execute at a very, very high level.
Well, yeah, because you don't know what's going to happen in a war zone. So like I tell everybody else, the pilots practice every day, or actually the entire unit practices every day for what happens in the war zone. I mean,
sure.
I worked with you. You were a scheduler for the pilots, and the curriculum you have every day, or you schedule for like months in advance, surprised me. Because you guys are doing basic flight maneuvers one time, and now you're going to do air-to-air or to ground. So this changes everything with bringing weapons to the aircraft, what kind of configurations and everything. So it's a really big every day, every flight is a change in everything, all the aircraft configurations and everything. It's really a big deal. But you guys need that. The pilots need that to get their training in. It's incredible. So speaking of training, like I mentioned before, could you tell us what your training was as a pilot? I know you go to some kind of survival school, and the curriculum at the actual flight school was pretty difficult, I understand. I know people who have done that, and they kind of disappear, you know, from public media, from the social media, because it's just too much, it's a lot to handle. Try not to get washed out. So could you explain
absolutely.
That a little bit?
Yeah. So you start off your first year is in undergraduate pilot training. They call UPT. And there, at least when I went through, we started off in the T-37, the Tweet, which they called the 7,000-pound dog whistle. You know, we used to joke that it was a very efficient machine at converting jet fuel to noise, and it produced some incidental thrust that we would use to fly from time to time. And you spend about 6 months in that, and it's really just learning, you know, the basics of how to fly an aircraft. Most of the guys that come in have no jet time, so it's you know, learning to kind of keep up with an aircraft. I mean, the Tweet's not super fast, but you know, you're still flying around 200-250 knots, you know, doing your approaches and things, and it's a lot faster than what happens in, you know, a Cessna 172 or something like that. And so you spend, like I said, about the first 6 months learning how to fly that, and then you move on to the T-38 Talon, which is a twin engine, a supersonic trainer that you spend. Then you learn how to fly tactically. So, you know, tactical formation, line abreast, you know, anywhere between 3 and 12,000 feet, usually with an altitude stack, and, you know, how to maneuver your aircraft. And, you know, we do that for various reasons. But first of all, just being that we can mass firepower, you know, we don't jam out each other's radar. It makes visual identification or acquisition of, you know, if it's a two-ship or a four-ship, very difficult because you're not on that horizon line together where it's easy to spot you. You know, so you learn how to kind of employ tactically. You don't do any weapons delivery. You may do a little bit of, depending on your instructor, you may do a little bit of like heat to guns and a couple other things. But nothing, you know, as far as employment, weapons employment. So that basically wraps up your first year in undergraduate pilot training. After that, then you go to what's called Intro to Fighter Fundamentals. I did mine down at Moody Air Force Base in Valdosta, Georgia. There you fly the AT-38. Which is kind of a modified version of the aircraft you just flew. They have a heads-up display, very, very basic compared to what's in the F-16, just, you know, basically
right.
a kind of a fixed sight type of thing. And there you start to do, you know, some of the kind of the dogfighting skills. You do offensive BFM where, you know, you're – behind an adversary and trying to maneuver your aircraft in a position to employ weapons and guns. Then you roll into like a defensive BFM, so you're the guy out front now with somebody behind you, and you kind of train to defend yourself, you know, how to kind of put them in the phone booth, like we used to say, so where they're not able to employ their weapons, defeat any gunshots that they may have. And, you know, our goal is always to go from defense to offense, so, you know, you – for some reason, maybe they ended up behind you, you got jumped, but through superior maneuvering and skill, you end up putting them out in front of you now and can hopefully take them out. And then from there, that's kind of just, you know, 1v1. Then you move on to air combat maneuvering, which is where you employ like two friendly aircraft against one or two adversary aircraft. So, you know, not just employing your aircraft, but now operating as part of the team. And then obviously that ratchets up the difficulty level quite a bit. And then you start to move on to kind of the surface-to-air portion of the training where, you know, you learn basic basically how to maneuver your aircraft in relation to a target on the ground for weapons employment. So, you know, the first couple rides, you start off in a very conventional, we call a box pattern, where you're, you know, you're going down one base, crosswind and final, on a big bomb circle that's very clearly marked, and, you know, you're just learning how to fly your altitude, fly your airspeed to get the picture looking out the window of, you know, what does a 30 dive bomb sight picture look like? What does a 45 hatted look like? What does a 10 low drag look like? All the different maneuvers and deliveries that you might be called on to do, you know, tactically, we're doing it from a very basic setup. And then obviously we start doing some, once we've gotten trained on that, then we go into like a low altitude, like what we call a pop pattern, where you're flying 500 feet above the ground at a predetermined distance. You're going to make a series of maneuvers to basically kind of check off to one side, pop up, roll in on the target, deliver, and then get outside what we call the frag, or that's the so after a bomb explodes and the metal fragments go out to upwards of a half mile sometimes to make sure that we're not flying into a cloud of metal, because maintenance isn't going to like you very well if you end up
right.
Pulling through those into your engine. So,
yeah,
and that's kind of the basics of, you know, what we learn in IFF, just the very very basics of weapons employment, you know, and that pretty much wraps that up. When you're finished with your IFS, then you go off to your RTU, which is called, I believe it's Reserve Training Unit, where you'll go and learn to fly whatever aircraft it is that you've been assigned to. So for me, it was the F-16. I went down to Kelly Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, and learned to fly the Block 30 with the GE-100 engine in it. And there
yes,
you learn now.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Those are planes from Springfield. Some of them are now. So.
Yeah. Yep. And so that's kind of where you learn how to, you know, now fly, take those basics, those fundamentals that you've learned over the last year and a half, and learn how to employ it on your MWS or main weapon system, which, you know, can vary. It can be the A-10, the F-15, the F-18, the F-16, whatever. And you actually learn how to employ that tactically. And so you come out of there, out of your RTU. It's basically the same flow as IFF. You learn the basics of dogfighting and air combat maneuvering and, you know, surface to air, and you go into surface attack tactics or SAT. And you learn how to use – I learned how to fly with the Lantern targeting pod. We were one of the first classes to graduate from RTU, night vision goggle qualified. That's
a big deal.
Yeah. It was kind of funny because I came back NVG qualified. I had a lot more hours than actually a lot of our instructors and our flight leads. And so that kind of set the trajectory for my career. I ended up, I was always the wingman with the most nighttime. So when we deployed, I flew nights because I flew a lot of nights when we deployed. When I became a flight lead, I flew nights as a flight lead. When I became an instructor pilot, I was the instructor with the most night vision hours, so I flew all of the all of the combat sorties at night once again. So it really just kind of – it's funny how something so small in the very beginning of your career can dictate, you know, the trajectory of how things go. So I flew more nights than I think just about anybody in our squadron, just because I happened to be a wingman that showed up night vision qualified with a few more hours than most, and so I just kind of got stuck on that night shift. But
right.
So then you come back from your RTU, and you know you're fully qualified in the aircraft, but you only are able to function at a wingman level, so you can't really lead a flight. You're just kind of hanging on the wing of your flight leader instructor, and you kind of build your experience. You learn from the instructors, you learn from the flight leads. And then after, you know, about 200-300 hours, then you're ready to kind of look at becoming either a two-ship or four-ship flight lead. So, you know, obviously the timeline's a little different for everybody. Some guys are just naturally a little better at leading flights. Other guys take a little more time to kind of grow into that role. But we all get there, you know, eventually. And, you know, that's the job for an instructor pilot, to kind of look and say, all right, you know, we got, you know, Lieutenant so-and-so, pretty sharp, you know, he's ahead of the aircraft, which is kind of what we say when a guy is, you know, you're either ahead of the aircraft or you're behind it. If you're ahead of the aircraft and you're thinking about the next 2, 3, 4 steps down the road, and that's where we want to be. You know, we want to be proactive, not reactive. When you are behind the jet, then you know you're missing fuel checks, you're missing check-ins on the radio, your flying is erratic, your comms on the radio are not clear or very concise, and you can hear it from a mile away as an instructor pilot. You know, when a kid's struggling, you might be 10, 20 miles away, but you can tell on the radio when a guy's really struggling, and so you know you kind of try to you know, do what you can from wherever you are, you know, to support your guy, try to get him, you know, back ahead of the jet. And because if you're not ahead, man, you're behind. And if you're behind, bad stuff happens. And, you know, there's been a long laundry list of guys that have, you know, paid the ultimate price because they forgot an ops check, or their tanks were unbalanced, or their fuel wasn't feeding and they didn't catch it. And just I could go on and on forever about that.
Well, they call it cockpit management for a reason, you know, fuel management, all this stuff you have. This is the thing about about being a pilot. Not only are you learning all that stuff, you still have to fly an airplane, and then you have to manage everything, all your systems, and then you have a problem, then you come down and let the mechanics fix it. So there's a lot of things involved just in flying, you know, the rocket. So what's it like? What was it like to transition to an F-16? What was that aircraft like for you?
You know, the thing I remember, Kevin, the most was it was just like trying to drink from a fire hose. You know, you think you come out of UPT and you come out of ISF, you're like, all right, man, I'm ready for this. I know the basics. I've got it all. But, I mean, you know, the basics are just that. They're just the basics. And you're expected to have that stuff down cold, be able to execute without hesitation. And then they start piling more stuff on top of you. Now, you know, when you get into that, to the F-16 training, you know, you're learning about getting in your 3-1 and all of the classified stuff where you learn about enemy threats and capabilities, how to combat that. You know, if you're flying against, you know, a MiG-29 versus, you know, a Su-27 versus MiG-21 versus some of the stuff now that China's got out there. You know, you're learning to go, okay, you know, this, I have my aircraft. It is what it is. You know, the F-16, I think, is one of the most beautiful airplanes in the world, but I'm partial because that's all I ever flew tactically. But, you know, now you've got to learn how to take all those basics and translate that into success against adversaries. You know, and no one airplane is superior in all aspects of everything you'd ask it to do. You know, the F-22 is fantastic. It's maneuverable. It has its flaws. The F-35 has its flaws. You know, the F-16, same thing. So you have to learn how to, you know, exploit weaknesses of other aircraft while, you know, trying to kind of compensate or cover up for your own. So it's just an absolute, you're just getting information poured into your brain and you just do your best to try to soak it all in. And, you know, fortunately we have just fantastic instructors. The guys at Kelly were top notch all the way. They're just, you know, they've been doing this instruction thing for a long time. And they can, just like on the radio, they can spot a guy in class, a guy that, like, hey, man, he's got that kind of faraway look in his eyes. I know he's a little overwhelmed. And, you know, they'll pull you aside after class and go, hey, man, I was talking about this. Do you tracking? You following what I'm saying? You know, and then you got to learn to do all this stuff at 400, 500, 600 knots. Things
yeah.
happen fast. You know, and when we talk about, you know, the speed of an aircraft, you might, you know, go into an engagement and you get up above 30,000 feet, get up above the Mach, you know. But what everybody forgets is that the adversary is doing the same thing. So I'm not just closing in at a guy at 1.2 Mach. He's closing in to me at 1.2 Mach as well. So we're coming at each other, so to speak, at a combined total of 2.4 Mach, which is 24 miles every minute. So that you're hauling the mail. So things
right.
happen very, very, very fast.
And yeah, then
so
you have
that's where
yes.
That's where,
yeah,
you know, where we talk about staying ahead of the aircraft. You know, you have to be able, you know, we pride ourselves on being having quick reaction time, but to be completely honest, you know, if you're reacting, you're already in trouble. You know, you want to be the guy that's pulling the strings and thinking, you know, you're playing, I always put it akin to, you know, you want to play chess, not checkers. I'm not thinking about the move I'm doing now. I'm thinking about three moves down the road so that, you know, when things happen, I'm expecting it. I'm ready for it. I've got a plan for it rather than going, you know, oh, boy, you know, hey, we got this and this is happening. We got to react right now, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. And that means, yeah, I could totally get that. And that's something that I would, now that you mention it, I would expect that. You know, you have to live that machine. You have to be one with the machine, and it's got to be part of you to be successful. You can't be thinking about other stuff. So you have to know, have a plan. That sounds very reasonable. So
absolutely.
I was going to ask you real quick about the what's the pilot? Okay, Toledo Singers. What's the Beehive like? I know it's a hierarchy of the older guys and the younger guys, and training goes on and everything. So what's the culture like of the fighter pilot beehive? Just a real quick.
It's over time it's changed significantly. I'm sure it's way different now than when I was in. But it's kind of like being in a fraternity on like a sports team. You know, you have to be able to function not only as a fighter pilot, but you got to also be the kind of guy that if you're stuck in the desert for 6 months in a very small room with another dude who's your wingman, you're combat paired. So you wake up with the guy, you eat breakfast with the guy, you work out with the guy, you fly with the guy, you sleep with, you know, not with, but
gotcha.
If there's any fighter pilots listening, they're like, whoa. But, you're literally, for all intents and purposes, married to this guy. And if you got a dude whose personality doesn't mesh, doesn't gel, or just is flat out annoying, that's going to make for a long deployment. So, you have to have the skills, but then you also have to have the social, the interpersonal skills to be able to get along, to function, in that environment. We are very, it's a cutthroat world, man. I mean, guys, there's nothing's really sacred. I mean, think about the only thing that we never really teased each other about was each other's kids, but spouses were fair game. Any physical issues, old Spock, our commander, you remember him? I mean, you know how he got his call sign with
yeah.
the ears. He's a general now, I believe, at the Pentagon, at least last I heard. We loved each other. We'd never say that to one another, but every one of us would have given our lives for the other. But we're too cool to say that. So of course we're just kind of macho and playing it off. But it's very competitive. You have to be able to. As an instructor, you might have, your squadron commander and you're out flying with him. If he, does something and you've got to debrief him on it, you have to be able to call him out. And you have to do that with confidence as an instructor. You have to be able to go, sir, respectfully, of course, diplomatically, but, you need to debrief it and you fix it. And then if you're the guy, the higher ranking individual, you have to be able to accept that. That critique and that debrief and not take offense and not be let pride kind of get in the way of going, I've got more hours in this jet than you do. There's nothing you can teach me kind of thing. So, guys are pretty, surprisingly, fighter pilots are very humble, especially in the debrief. The tape doesn't lie. You can see everything that we do in that jet. I can see every switch, every communication that we make is all recorded. It's all we replay it all. So it's very, you have to be open. You have to be honest, and you can't let pride get in the way. As much as you want to sometimes, if I had a young captain back there gunning me because my defensive BFM was terrible that day, it's not going to do any good for me to sit there and go, oh, well, you just got lucky, or, my jet, I got a Flickus, warning light at the wrong time, or this or that. You just, here's what you did well. Here's what I screwed up. Here's how I fixed what I did. Here's how we build on what you did well. And you have to be very, open to criticism. And, I could spend hours talking about the dynamics. I mean, there's, just so much that goes into it, but you got to be a good dude. You got to be thick-skinned. You got to be, you got to have the skill to do it. It's a lot of layers to that cake.
Yes, I totally agree. Thick-skinned for sure. Even when enlisted people go to ops, how it is. It's and you know what? They have to be like that. You guys have to be. It's not a Top Gun kind of thing. It's kind of like you guys are, once you get in that plane and you're strapped down on the seat and you take off, it's very serious. It's you're on a rocket. You're on an afterburning engine and everything. And things could go wrong. So it's a big responsibility. Anybody, every time I see a pilot go up, I mean, that's, I like being on the ground. That's, I feel safer there. I'm not a pilot type, but you know, we worked on the airplanes and everything, but you know, we're not flying in them. Everybody has their own job and everybody works together. And our job is to give you those aircraft so you guys can fly and, you know, get your studies in and your qualifications. So we know our roles and, you know, we do them well, we respect it. And you are under your second role as a fighter pilot versus what you did before. So
yeah.
Next segment, this is going to get good. We're going to ask you, I'm going to ask you what it's like to fly in combat.
Okay. You know, it's funny you talk about, you know, the trust that we have in the maintainers on the ground. The very first time I ever put gear in the well and went into Iraq, I just remember the feeling of knowing that I'm in a country where we're not liked, okay? And there's no place in this country where I can set this aircraft down if I have a problem. I have to, you know, I mean, if you have to punch, you know, if you have to try to put it into a divert base, you know, you just don't have a lot of options there. You know, you're one bad decision away from literally being on CNN. And, you know, without getting too dramatic about it, but, you know, I think about, you know, I think his last name was Durant. He was a Hilo pilot that was captured, just kind of drugged through the streets, you know, and I'm like, man, I don't want that to be me, for my family, you know, I mean, for them to have to see that, for them to see me, you know, sitting in front of a table making, you know, with, you know, trying to make a forced confession or something like that. I mean, it's just, you know, you just don't want to be there. You don't want to be that guy. So you have to have an immense amount of trust in the fuelers you know, when those guys are going out and putting gas in the jet, the maintainers that are doing all of the maintenance on the jet, every single system, avionics, you know, your weapons, it's this enormous team that comes together to generate a combat aircraft that's, you know, full up and ready to go. And then there you are as a pilot sitting there going, man, all these guys put all their blood, sweat, tears, time, effort, you know, into generating this aircraft. I mean, you know, and you know, Kevin, I mean, how many hours of maintenance go into every flying hour for the F-16? It's astounding. And, you know, and so you feel a lot of responsibility, or at least I always did as a pilot, to go, listen, man, all these guys and gals put their effort into getting this aircraft ready to go. And, you know, and now it's up to me to take this aircraft and do with it, you know, what we've got to do with it, you know, whatever mission we're tasked for that day, to go out and, you know, to execute. Because if I don't, if I fail, then I've failed everybody else down the chain, that have worked so hard to put, you know, this aircraft where it needed to be able to go out and either train, in peacetime or employ in combat. So I always felt it's just an enormous amount of responsibility. You know, just kind of like I was, you know, carrying the weight of everybody that did everything they did to get that aircraft ready to go out and fly. And so, you know, you're right. It is very serious. I mean, I'm not a super serious guy, as you know. I like to joke around. I mean, I'm about as much of a cut up as there is, but you know, when you're actually out there and doing the job, you know, there's just this immense amount of responsibility that you feel, you know, to go out and do your part of it well, so that all of the effort of everybody else isn't wasted, which is probably something that most folks don't really realize. You know, we completely are aware that, you know, maintenance will a lot of times work, you know, early mornings, late nights, overnights, in bad weather, cold, rain, you know, hot, you know, to be able to turn an aircraft, get it ready to go so we can go out and do our mission. And so, you know, I always try to be that guy to, you know, walk up, shake the crew chief's hand, hey, man, thanks. You know, thanks for getting this thing ready. And, you know, we'll talk about, you know, a lot of times about family or stuff that's going on. And then when I got done and I was, you know, doing my post-flight and filling out the 781s, to go shake their hand, hey, man, thanks. It was a good jet today. Thanks for all the work you put in. You know, because you just you're one part of it, you're a big part of it, but boy, without the maintenance, I mean, we're just really good looking pedestrians, right?
That's right, with cool jackets. Yeah, and if you do mess up, the tradition is the pilots will buy a beer, you know, for the crew, or a case of beer.
Yep.
So that used to be the culture back in the 80s. Every trip was there's a truckload of beer where maintenance arrived.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So
and you know another thing, Kevin, that's really kind of you know, one of the greatest honors of my career was. When we would do an incentive ride for one of our enlisted folks or the officers if they were, you know, like logistics or something like that. Anytime we would give an incentive ride, quite often I would get asked by especially the crew chiefs, a couple of the security policemen, that type of thing, if, hey, man, would you be the guy to fly me? And I was, you know, I was always felt honored that they could have any one of the guys that are flying, but they asked for me. You know, because of, you know, and I'd ask them, okay, I'm like, dude, I'm happy to fly you, but, you know, can I ask why? They're like, well, you just, you know, you're a good guy. I remember, and they'd tell stories, you know, I remember when, you know, it was, you know, shitty weather and, you know, you came out, brought some coffee out or whatever. And, you know, just that kind of thing, just to try to, just to be a good guy, you know, just don't be that asshole that nobody likes. You know, it's like, oh crap, you know, got Glon's coming out here. He's going to tear this jet apart and blah, blah, blah. And so that was, you know, the biggest honor was me for a guy who could have chosen any one of the pilots in the squadron to go, hey, dude, I want you to be the guy that takes me out on this once in a lifetime, once in a career opportunity to go out and get a backseat ride in one of the, you know, coolest fighters in the world. And, you know, that meant a ton to me as a pilot. To hear guys, you know, ask for me by name because, you know, they could have had anybody, but they chose me because, you know, hopefully I made some positive impact on them. And so that was kind of cool. That was honestly, you know, the awards, the decks, the, you know, all the other junk, you know, that's all nice too. But in the end, you know, what meant the most to me was that I had the respect, at least I hope I did, of the guys and gals that were out doing the maintenance and doing the work on the airplanes to get them ready to go.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I chose you to come on this show, because of that. Because we worked together. You were the scheduler, and I was the pro soup for 9 months, and we worked well together. And I appreciated what you did, and hopefully you appreciated what I did. And my goal was to give you the most aircraft I could, you know, with the resources I had. So I have a lot of work behind that, but so I know we were talking about flying, doing, you know, over Iraq and the possibility of you actually being shot down or something. And I remember when we were at Northern Watch in '96, they were doing touch and goes on Iraqi runways. Talk about people were crazy. So we wouldn't do anything like that. They had something to prove. The Brits did. It seemed like. Yeah, a chip on their shoulder. So, so your experiences, because I know you probably did a lot of weapons deliveries over there, and whatever else your, I don't know what your mission was. The thing about this is the maintenance people don't know what the pilots do once, you know, from the briefing when they take off. We have no idea what you guys are, what the mission is, and that's on purpose. You know, nobody, that's none of our business. All we do is fix airplanes. But sometimes the bombs would disappear at the end of the flight. And that's how you know, hey, this is they dropped a bomb or whatever. We would keep track of that stuff, by the way. So just curious. So you did that kind of stuff, and you had other people in your, you know, in your little group or whatever, your formation. And if everybody knows that we use in the aircraft world let's see, ship lingo, like foreship and knots and everything like that, and rudder and keel beams and everything. So it's the same thing, but in the sky. It's kind of unique. So KIAS, you're talking about knots, indicated airspeed. So if you don't know the language, and the same with the airline, they do the same thing. Amazing, you know, it's just a coincidence. Why people don't know about. So for my audience, that's how it goes. So tell me about that.
What was always cool, and what we tried to do, you know, as much as we could, is, you know, if you would go out and say you had a weapons delivery, you know, combat, that type of thing, you know, you bring the weapons guys over, the guys that loaded the bombs, the guys that built the bombs, the avionics guys that serviced the targeting pod, the crew chief whose aircraft it was, try to bring them in, you know, and at an appropriate classification level, go, hey, you know, watch this tape, man. Here's a bomb coming off. Here's the targeting pod lasing it in. Here's the weapons impact. Here, you know, so guys can see that. And man, there is nothing more motivating to, you know, to an avionics guy or a crew chief or a weapons loader to watch all of their hard work, you know, come to fruition in a successful weapons delivery. And, you know, I mean, man, that dude, when they walk out of there, they run through a brick wall, you know, because they're just so jacked yes. up to see, you know, because you know, they probably worked all night to, you know, to build up a couple of, you know, GBU-12s and make sure the fusing's right and the wiring is correct and all the stuff they got to do. But when they watch that bomb hit and do what it's designed to do, you know, there's nothing more motivational to guys and gals to see that. And, you know, so, and you can't do that all the time. Obviously, there's, you know, issues with classification and such, and just sometimes
right.
generally
yeah.
it's time. But yeah, that's, you know, that was an awesome thing where we could do that. Even like Snowbird and the different things, we'd take lives out there and drop them. It was always cool for them to see that, and they enjoyed it to see all that. So.
Yeah, that's Snowbird was Tucson, Arizona. We go there every year, pretty much, and drop live bombs, and it was just everything made my career great. I love being on deployments, whether it was overseas or in the States, just to get away, and it's 24/7 flying the aircraft and training, and it's the best way to, in my opinion, to sharpen everybody's skills and to work with limited resources, and it's great. You get to know the pilots better and your other crew members and everything. But so you're trained for the ejections and everything in case that did happen. And we do hear about these stories where people are behind the enemy lines and they're able to escape and get out and all those kind of things. But I'm sure it's not anything you want to handle on your own. But you do know, can you tell us a little bit about what happened in one of your trips to Iraq, one of your wingmen? I don't know if you want to talk about that or not, or just briefly mention that.
And you know, just you're so busy when you take off, you don't have time to sit there and think about what's happening, potential, you know, for bad things to happen. I mean, just literally, you know, so involved doing everything you need to do to accomplish the mission that there isn't time for that, you know, to be scared or have fear or to, you know, be worried about things. I mean, just if you're doing that, man, you're not prioritizing correctly. So, you know, so you don't really have that, but I mean, you know, in the back of your mind, it's there and you know it's there, and just kind of push that down and focus on the mission. But yeah, so for with Sonny, losing him obviously was a huge blow. I was a flight lead. He was my wingman for that night. We were combat paired. We'd flown together pretty much every night that we were there. And he was senior to me in rank. He was an instructor. At the time, I was not. He was a Delta pilot, had far more military and civilian hours than I did. But, you know, for that night, I was a flight lead, and he was a wingman. And it was a very weird night. I mean, it was dark. There was no clouds. The weather was clear. But if you've ever been over to Iraq, you know it's not uncommon at all to look up in the sky on a clear night. You know, the weather forecast calls for skies clear. You look up and you can't see the stars. The moon's very, very faint. There's just a lot of haze, a lot of smoke, a lot of dust, particulate in the atmosphere that just blocks out that light. And it's not uncommon in Iraq at that time. They burned everything. all their trash and such. So, you know, there was a lot of particulate in the air from that. And that was the night that we flew. I mean, I remember I walked out the flight line, I look up, and I'm like, man, I can't see the stars. Because normally we focus our NVGs in life support. And, you know, as a last-minute check, I'd always just kind of don the goggles, take a look at the stars just to make sure that, you know, nothing shifted in my helmet bag when I was going, you know, out to the jet, just as the last-minute QC of that. And I just looked up, and I was going to do that, and there's nothing up there for me to focus on. So just kind of went out and trusted that everything was like it needed to be. I was actually, I believe, supposed to take his jet. I had my own aircraft. We did a last-minute tail swap because his wasn't ready. And as you know, they always are trying to get the flight lead, the first aircraft that's ready to go, because you're going to start up, you're going to get on the radios, you're going to start doing all the coordination on the ground that you need to do. And the wingman's just, you know, has a little less responsibility in that area. So he would go to the second one that was ready. So I ended up actually swapping tails with him. And, you know, so we get up, we start up, we taxi out. Everything's normal. I take off. Climb up to altitude, start heading to where I'm supposed to go to, where we were fragged to go to, and get a call from I believe it's Kingpin, telling us to contact Warhawk, who is basically the KOC, and they're directing us. We got troops in contact. They want us to go out there and see what we can do. So I start checking my wingman in on the radio, and I'm not getting a hold of him. I can't find him on the radio. I'm not seeing his Link 16 track. I saw it initially, but then it went away, and those could age out over time. You know, so even if the system went down, you'd still see some, you know, false inputs, still that contact aged out. And so I call back to the SOS. I'm like, hey, did number two come back? They're like, no, man, we saw two good burner plumes. Everything's good. I said, all right, well, you know, I'm having a hard time getting them on the radio. And the supervisor flying at that time said, well, I'll check the two main diverts, Kirkuk and Al-Assad, and see if maybe he went there. Maybe his radio wasn't working, something like that. And so he calls him back about 2 or 3 minutes later. He's like, hey, man, no, he didn't go there. I don't know what to tell you. And so I'm like, well, you know, I'm delaying talking to Warhawk because I'm trying to – I don't want to say the words, I don't know where my wingman is, because that's immensely embarrassing for me, for him, for us, for our squadron, for, you know, everything. And, you know, finally I have to tell him, you know, I'm like, hey, stand by. I can't get my wingman on the radio. And so they're like, oh, okay, copy that. We'll stand by. Like, you know, it's kind of like dumbasses. And so about that time I get a call from base, and they give me some coordinates. They ask me to take a look at them. And it's right very close to the base. So I do. I go back over the base. I'm looking down. I'm like, man, I see what looks to be a very, you know, a small, cool spot in the desert, you know, surrounded by, you know, standard temperature desert sand. And I didn't know at the time, but that was the crash site of where he had crashed. And so I don't know what I'm looking at, but I'm really starting to get kind of a sinking feeling in my stomach. And then I get our squadron commander come on the radio. And he tells me, hey, bud, and he's being, like, super, like, treating me with kid gloves. He's like, hey, man, we're just going to bring you back. We're going to, you know, want you to burn down fuel over the airfield. And, you know, when you feel comfortable, go ahead and land. And no big rush. It's all good. You know, just very – that's not how we are. That's not how we talk. But I think at that point they started to realize what had happened, that he had crashed. And so I landed. You know, when I burnt down fuel a little bit, worst landing in my career, because at that point my brain's kind of catching up to what I said. You know, I think something bad has happened here. And so I taxi in, crew chief shuts me down. I can see it immediately in his face. You know, the guy looks like he's about to throw up. And I shut down and I'm like, hey man, what's going on? And by then our squadron commander come out and met me at the jet. And the minute I saw him, I just dropped to my knees and I said, he's gone, isn't he? And he said, yeah, he's gone. We think, but we don't know. He's just pick your head up, stay in the game. You know, we don't know for sure anything. And within about an hour, they pretty well confirmed that he had crashed. It was like 5 miles off the departure into the runway. We really don't know what happened. There wasn't a lot of data available as to, you know, what happened. I think the official Air Force investigation said it was spatial disorientation. But I firmly believe, I believe in my heart, and I will always believe until the day I die, that something happened that led him into that path. Sonny was too good of a pilot. He was too experienced. You know, I know these aren't absolutes. They aren't guarantees that bad things can't happen, but I have a lot of respect for him as a fighter pilot, and I know that he wouldn't put himself in a bad position unless something kind of brought him down that path. And so, you know, the truth is I don't honestly know whether there was some sort of aircraft malfunction, if something happened where he was, you know, I mean, it was not uncommon for them to use lasers against us to try to blind us. You know, there's probably about 10 things I could think of, you know, that I feel like could have maybe led him down that path. But in the end, I don't honestly know. Someday when I die and go to wherever the hell I'm going, I'll hopefully meet Sonny there and we'll have that final debrief over a beer and talk about what the hell just really happened. Because I don't know. You know, that was a hell of a tough day, man. I mean, it really shook me. I mean, it takes a lot, and that did it. You know, and just to lose a squadron mate, but, you know, a lot of folks don't know this. Sonny and I grew up in the same small town, went to the same high school. Our parents knew each other. We knew a lot of the same folks. He was from McClure, I was from Napoleon, and they're like literally 10 minutes apart. So, you know,
didn't know that.
A lot of folks don't. And we were, you know, so we were close, you know, not just as you know, brothers in arms, but I mean, outside of that, I mean, he was the reason I became a fighter pilot. You know, he was on my interview board. He was the biggest dick to me in the interview. But he did that because he didn't want anyone to perceive, because we knew each other, because we were from the same area, that he was bringing me on board because I knew him. You know, he wanted it to be based on merit, not on, you know, nepotism isn't the right word, but, you know, on the fact that he knew me and I knew him. And so, you know, it was just, it shook me losing him. And, you know, of course you second guess yourself and, you know, with the jet switch, should that have been me? You know, it should have been. That was supposed to be my tail. If something
right
with that
I
jet,
see now.
Yeah, you know, that could be me. And then you wonder,
well,
was he tired? Was
yeah.
he this? Was he that? I mean, there's just so much, man.
It was an Iowa jet, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. I'll just leave. I'll put it there. I just leave it alone. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
we won't say anything.
But to be fair, the Toledo tails, if there were issues, and all of the jets had minor things, you know, some engines ran hot, some engines produced less thrust, some aircraft did wonky things at different times.
Yes.
But the Toledo jets, we kind of knew the history. The Iowa jets, we didn't have as much awareness on that. So, and
yeah,
it's not a ding. I'm not dinging anybody on any side. Just to say that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, somebody you've known all your life, and then, you know, you're hanging out with somebody else that you just met maybe a week ago, and you don't know everything about that person that you do about the person you spent your whole life with, kind of thing. So, you know, I don't know, man. I really wish I had better answers. I just don't.
Yeah, I understand. That's tragic. Even you lose mechanics, but this one is a unique unique thing. You know, he's your you know him so well, and then, you know, for a lifetime, and then it's in combat, you know, and that's a huge thing. So one more question. We only have 4 minutes left. I want to ask you real quick, what do you think about the situation that's going on in Afghanistan right now?
You know, first and foremost, man, you know, my heart goes out to the Afghan people. They deserve better, I think. You know, the Taliban, that's a nasty group, man. And you know, we were there for so long. There were relationships that were formed. There were, you know, interactions between them and us. And anybody, I'm afraid, anybody over there that's got, you know, that in their mind is associated with the United States military or have a target on their back. And a lot of these folks were just doing what they felt was right, or maybe what they were doing what they needed to do to put food on the table for their families. excuse me. But, you know, and unfortunately they're going to pay a very, very severe price for that. And that's the part that really breaks my heart. You know, because they're good people. They're hardworking people. The Iraqis are the same way. The majority of them just want to live their life, raise their family, you know, work, have a normal life, and go about their business. And the Afghanis are the same way. And so, you know, it just really breaks my heart that, you know, there wasn't some sort of a plan to, you know, just I don't want to get too far into it, but just I feel like kind of a, hey, we're gonna just rip this Band-Aid off, you know, and deal with the fallout rather than, you know, have an organized plan and do it in a more organized fashion.
One more question with almost 3 minutes left. What does the Constitution mean to a fighter pilot? How does that work?
Well, I mean, we raise our hand, we take our oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States to the best of our abilities. And so, you know, you have so much discretion and so much power at your fingertips. I mean, you literally have the ability to change things with one bomb. And so the amount of responsibility that you carry, you know, you are an extension of the United States, an extension of the president of the armed forces. And, you know, so you have to hold yourself to an extremely high standard in your conduct, in how you execute and what you do. You have to be professional because you are literally carrying the power of life and death in your hands. And, you know, that's an immense responsibility. And so you have to be on your game. You have to bring your A game. There is no off days, no bad hair days. Not, you know, you have to be on your game because you need to. We're carrying through a mission that has gone through, you know, from the time that our country was formed up until, you know, current events. You're an extension of policy by other means. I mean, we're executing the dictates of our politicians, and you have to do that in the best way. And man, you have sometimes, just like in the Constitution, there's a lot of room for interpretation and such. And so, you know, you just have to make decisions that you know you can live with if things don't go the way you plan them to go.
Brad, that was beautifully put. I'm going to take that and write that down. That's awesome. Coming from, and that's one thing I always talk about when I'm on the speaking circuit, the military lives the Constitution every day, and they put themselves in harm's way. So I want to say thank you, Brad, for coming on. And if anything else you want to say, we have 30 seconds left. Appreciate you being here with us.
Yeah, absolutely, Kevin. I appreciate the chance to come on here and talk and tell stories and kind of, you know, I'll tell you what, I retired February 14. It feels like a lifetime ago, and I miss it every day.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much. So,
all right, thank
everybody,
you,
that's a great program. Everybody, thank you very much. We'll see you next week, 7 o'clock Wednesday. Goodbye, everybody. Thank you.